Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, chances are you've heard the name Sally Jewell in engineering, business, recreational, environmental, or political news. Her career has touched on all of those areas, from her early days in the oil fields of Oklahoma to a long stretch in the banking industry, from a very successful run as CEO of REI to becoming only the second woman to serve as U.S. Secretary of the Interior. Oh, and she's climbed Mount Rainier 7 times and raised 2 children. Sally Jewell grew up in the Seattle area and studied at the University of Washington. She's headed to Harvard University next to teach at the Kennedy School. During her brief hiatus back home, KUOW's terrestrial host, Ashley Ahern, was able to sit Jewell down long enough for an in-depth conversation on how business and politics impact the environment in these tumultuous times. They spoke on August 31st at the Mountaineers Program Center. Sonia Harris recorded the event. We're presenting our broadcast version here. To listen to the full event, go to kuow.org/speakersforum.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Tom Vogel. I'm the CEO of the Mountaineers, and we're just thrilled to have you here tonight. Quick show of hands, how many Mountaineers members do we have in the audience tonight? Great. A special welcome to all you Mountaineers. But for those of you who are not Mountaineers, I just want to tell you just a couple of quick things about this amazing organization. For 111 years, the Mountaineers have helped people fall in love with the outdoors. Our long-term vision is to be protectors of the outdoor experience a century from now and beyond. And a core value of the Mountaineers is really about adventure, but our organization is really about a lot more than that. We like to talk about our mission as being adventure with purpose. And our purpose are things like teaching skills so that people can get into the outdoors safely and responsibly. They inspire people to become part of a community and then pass that knowledge on to others. They also are inspired to pass on that knowledge and that love of the outdoors to future generations. And then finally, and this is really a great tie-in for our theme tonight, we are fierce protectors of the outdoor experience. We love to really be a voice for our wild places and our public lands. We do all of this through our education and our advocacy programs, as well as hosting events like this, and then also through our publishing division, which publishes a lot of really wonderful conservation titles, including through our conservation imprint, Braided River. We have a shared passion for being a voice for our public lands, and this is really what brings us together tonight. So thanks for being here tonight, but more importantly, thanks for really caring about our public lands, especially at these times. It's really important work, and we really appreciate you being here tonight. It's now my honor to introduce Dean Lisa Gromlich, who is the Mary Laird Wood Professor and Dean of the University of Washington College of Environment. Lisa previously served as director of University of Arizona's Institute for the Study of Planet Earth and Montana State University's Big Sky Institute. As a scholar, Gromlich pioneered the use of tree ring and other proxy data to understand long-term trends in climate change, a topic of significant importance here in Western North America. With that, welcome Dean Gromlich.
Thank you, Tom. And it's great to see all of you here. And I want to thank our event partners, KUOW and the Mountaineers. So how many here are people are fans of terrestrial? Yay. Okay. So you may not realize that terrestrial is staffed. You're sort of thinking I'm about to list this sort of cast of thousands. There is a part-time editor and sound designer, and then there is a force of nature named Ashley Ahern, who conceived of Terrestrial. She does the research, she does the writing, she does the reporting, she hosts the show. She takes us all over the place. She does these deep dives from the polluted industrial neighborhoods in Alabama to churches in Colorado. And she is doing a bang-up job. Since launching the podcast in June, it has had over 500,000 downloads in 3 months. 500,000 downloads. In podcast world, that makes it in the top 1% of the 400,000 podcasts that are out there. 3 months. So let me tell you a little bit about the dynamo behind Terrestrial. Ashley Ahern is one of KUOW's award-winning environmental reporters and the host of Terrestrial. For over a decade, she has been the voice we have listened to around the environment for NPR and for member stations. Her stories aired on Morning Edition, Marketplace, All Things Considered, and many, many other national and local shows. She has a master's in science journalism from USC's Annenberg School. And when she isn't telling stories about our changing planet, you can spot her riding her motorcycle, snowboarding, or hiking with her husband, and what might be arguably the world's cutest labradoodle. Ashley and I have had a lot of conversations about Terrestrial. And we share a passion for finding ways to communicate science that connect these big, thorny environmental challenges that we all face with our everyday lives. And it is clear to me that Ashley is telling stories that matter. She speaks very, very directly to her audience and explores the choices we are making in the world that we are changing. And tonight, we get to sort of see her in action. She's going to be bringing us into a conversation with Sally Jewell. All of you know Sally Jewell, but let me just remind you that as Secretary of the Interior under President Obama, Sally Jewell worked to promote a robust economy coupled with long-term sustainability of our natural world and its diverse people. During her tenure, she was recognized for taking the long view and for using science-based, landscape-level, and very collaborative approaches to natural resource management. She and her team had a number of major accomplishments, too many to list, but I do want to highlight that she worked to build a trust-based nation-to-nation relationship with Indigenous communities. She championed the importance of science to better understand Earth systems, and she worked across political parties to advance long-term conservation of our nation's most valuable and irreplaceable natural, cultural, and historic treasures. Throughout her career, Sally has been committed to connecting people to nature, particularly youth. And this includes encouraging tens of millions of young people to play, learn, and save and work on public lands. Prior to serving on President Obama's cabinet, Sally was president and CEO of REI. She served... Exactly. She served 19 years in commercial banking and began her career as an engineer in the energy sector. She's long been active in governance and in leadership boards for corporations and nonprofits. We benefited greatly at UW from her role as a UW regent. And we're now really honored to have Sally serving as a distinguished fellow in the College of the Environment. So this event is put on by three terrific institutions, my UW College of the Environment, the Mountaineers, and KUOW's Terrestrial. And I want to thank all of you who support one or more of these organizations. I just want to make a pitch. I love Terrestrial. If we want podcasts of the quality and innovation of Terrestrial, we need to support it. And I hope you will join me in making sure that Terrestrial stays the vibrant leader in the podcast world that it's on a trajectory to be. So without further ado, let me please join me in welcoming Ashley Ahern and Sally Jewell.
You like our outfits. I have a face for radio. My dad's been telling me since I was a kid.
Ashley.
Don't worry. All right, before we get started, I need to clear the air. We did not plan our outfits.
She didn't tell me about the boots expectation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or the lipstick, but, you know, we'll work on it. So I have to give a big thank you to all of you guys for coming out tonight. I have been really looking forward to this evening for a while now, and to you, Sally, for taking time out of your very busy career, busy travels being back in the Northwest, and then heading to Boston here in a few, well, Cambridge in a couple days now, right?
Yep.
Sorry. Yeah. And to Fremont Brewing for the wonderful brews beforehand. Yes, you guys rock. And a big thank you and a shout out to Lisa Wang at KUOW. She has been organizing this thing, but like just keeping everybody on track, and we couldn't have done it without her. She's a hero. All right, so the last time I interviewed Sally, we were wearing snowshoes, and we had hiked from Paradise Lodge out to look over the Nisqually Glacier. And this is a glacier that has receded a mile up its course, up its valley. And it was a really striking, one of those moments where climate change is suddenly very real for me. And those happened a lot over the course of covering this beat. And I was talking to Sally and interviewing her, and of course she was representing the Obama administration. And I remember thinking at the time, man, I can't wait to talk to her when she's not in office anymore, or not serving, so that I can get like find out how the sausage is made. So when I when she was back, I got wind of it and I said, we got to do this event. So that's how this kind of came to be, and I couldn't be more grateful for your time. So tonight we're going to talk about a lot of different things. I was really looking forward to getting a debrief of her time with the Obama administration, but also a look ahead at where we stand with the Trump administration. How are things looking? Where are her biggest concerns? But I want to start with just kind of what during your time serving as the Secretary of the Interior, what kept you up at night? What were your big sources of the big ones for you?
Well, generally, I like to sleep well. My husband Warren, who's front row center, will know that normally I'm pretty good at that. But there were a few moments, so I guess we're going to start with the downers as opposed to the upper moments. But
that's how the news works, right?
Nice
we only
job.
Talk about the
I
bad
know,
news.
That's right. That's what everybody's here to hear about.
That's right.
Right.
No, we'll get to some good stuff, I promise, guys.
No, there were moments. And I guess if I were to synthesize, you know, what did they have in common? It's all where human life was at risk in some way. So one was the crazy shutdown of the government. You all remember that? We shut down the government. So why were human lives at risk as it related to Interior? Well, people love their national parks. They're big drivers of the economy. And in the state of Utah, they really wanted those national parks, those Mighty Five, to remain open. And there was an effort by sheriffs in some of the local counties to take over the national parks by force. I'm not making this up. So I called Governor Herbert and said, you know, this isn't working for me. You've actually got armed police officers that want to take on our armed police officers who are required to shut down the parks by law and reopen them, and we're going to have people in a very dangerous situation. That's the first instance where I was really worried about people's lives, and we negotiated into the night to have the state pick up the tab to reopen the national parks. And so we did that in 7 different locations, but only one, and that was Utah, where they're thinking about actually an armed confrontation. Second, you may recall a little incident with a deadbeat rancher in Bunkerville, Nevada, named Cliven Bundy. Remember that? Yeah, so he hasn't paid grazing fees for over 20 years. He's grazing his cattle on not only without permits, but in areas that are drought-stricken and in parts of Glen Canyon National Recreation Area. That's not okay. So we actually went to do a cattle roundup, and we were met with armed militias. Interestingly, as I was explaining to Ashley, some of the same people that were showing up in Charlottesville. So these are the Oath Keepers, the Three Percenters, pretty scary stuff. And I made the very, very difficult decision in the wee hours of the morning to say we have to stand down, we have to let the cattle go. It's not, we do not want to have a repeat of Waco, Texas, or Ruby Ridge, Idaho, where people are going to lose their lives. We'll work on this through the court system, and of course that's working its way very, very slowly through the courts now. The Bundys are in prison in Nevada, and they are yet to stand trial. Third one, some of the same characters, the Bundy boys again, this time Ammon and Ryan, and the takeover of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. And then the last one, most recently, the showing of solidarity in peaceful protests around the Dakota Access Pipeline on the Standing Rock Reservation. Those were sleepless nights and very difficult, where you're trying to protect human life, protect human rights, but also do what's sensible and practical. So I don't miss that part of the job, Ashley.
Yeah.
Not so much. No.
And it sounds like you really coasted through.
It really,
honestly.
Yeah.
It flew by.
Yeah. Now can we go up a little bit?
How many folks in the audience traveled to Standing Rock? I'm curious. Anybody? I see a couple hands. I was there, and there were a lot of people actually from the Pacific Northwest. I met a bunch of people from Bellingham, folks that had traveled to bring supplies. And I was there with a member of the Standing Rock Sioux named Ace Baker, who's married to a woman in the Swinomish tribe here in Washington State. And he and I went there together, and it was one of the most illuminating experiences of my career, talking to somebody, you know, from that place. And also incredibly inspiring, the people that had traveled to that place. I flew to North Dakota the morning after the election, and was just in kind of a state. Everyone there was kind of in a, didn't know what was going to happen, what this meant. And I guess I just wondered, Sally, watching what was happening, the thousands of people that came to that place to show, as you say, solidarity, do you have any regrets about how the Obama administration handled that and how it got to that point where people were getting hurt and there were armed, you know, the way the police were handling it on the ground there?
Generally, I don't have regrets about my team and the way they handled it. I think they handled it with tremendous professionalism. So the Department of the Interior's role in this particular incident was around the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which maintains the law enforcement on the Standing Rock Tribe. We brought resources in from all over. And those law enforcement officers, who are very well trained and have incredibly difficult jobs, they're patrolling really large areas with very few resources, and there's not enough of them to go around, were the police that the tribal members trusted. And they did a phenomenal job of keeping people safe and keeping us informed. The people on the ground did not trust the sheriff, and I think that there was reason why in terms of how people were treated. But I'm incredibly proud of the law enforcement resources from the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the job that they did. I think if there's a regret writ large from the Obama administration, it is that a project like that got that far down the track, where you had one last permit, which was an easement from the Army Corps of Engineers before the pipeline moved forward. And the tribe had been speaking up in its concerns about this, at least from, I know that there's a video record from 2012, and I believe it goes back as early as 2010. The companies were checking a box with the tribe, but not taking it seriously enough. The consultation box. So they can consult, but if it's not authentic consultation, it doesn't count. And I don't think that we jumped on it in the Army Corps as soon as we could have, although I'm very proud of Joellen Darcy, who was the civilian head of the Army Corps, for standing up to her colonels and saying, no, this is wrong. We are not going to go forward with this until appropriate consultation takes place. And that was the decision that was made. In spite of tremendous pressure that she was undertaking from her own staff and from people outside. So that was reversed by the Trump administration. However, there are ongoing lawsuits, and the tribe is in much better legal shape than it would have been, I think, had we not taken the actions and the Army Corps not taken the actions that it took. But I guess I think about this in the context of, you know, potentially losing a battle but winning a war. So Dave Archambault, who's become a friend and someone that
I've...
Chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. I first met when I visited Standing Rock, before the president visited, actually. I think it was in 2014, and he took me all over the reservation. I went from the prisons to the schools to the immersion classes for kindergartners where they're teaching the language to where they were setting up for their sunrise ceremony, which was a pretty spiritual experience. And he was shocked by the show of support and very moved by that. In fact, we were on stage together with a group of tribal youth in Washington, D.C. not long after that. And it was an awakening for the whole tribal community in the United States, and I think for the United States recognizing the trust and treaty obligations that our government has to tribal communities. I don't think it's something that was on our radar before to the extent that it is now. So even though oil is flowing in the pipeline and there is a lawsuit underway, I think that Dave would say, and many tribal leaders would say, you're not going to put this genie back in the bottle. We know how to organize, we know how to work together, and we will work together so that Resolution Copper doesn't build its mine on a sacred site for the San Carlos Apache, and maybe deal with issues with non-native salmon and all of these things that are kind of swirling around the news right now that really do have a lot to do with the commitments we made to the indigenous people of this country that we have not generally done a very good job of upholding. So that's, I think, winning a war, and I think that it has changed the way this country understands the relationship with Native people, and I think that that's a good thing, even though I do feel like we've had a setback with this administration and its behavior, but that's by no means, I think, how it's going to play out over the long term.
I want to talk about Malheur. That was riveting, that story as it was unfolding. I'm sure you were all kind of chained to the news and watching what was happening there. But take us behind the scenes. What were the conversations that you were having with the White House about how to diffuse that at the time?
I think everybody was frustrated by Malheur. You're probably saying, why didn't they turn off the power? Why didn't they cut off the water? Well, you know, we're set up for all kinds of natural disasters. So there's generators and there's fuel and there's wells and, you know, so that wouldn't have worked so well. But nonetheless, really we took the lead from the FBI. And I think the FBI, as frustrating as it was for me and Governor Kate Brown and Oregon and others to sort of sit back and watch as these guys ran roughshod over a beautiful wildlife refuge that is burial ground and a place of artifacts for the Burns Paiute tribe and, you know, a place where they needed to be doing work in order to support the objectives of the refuge. The reality was the FBI felt, and I think rightfully so, that if you just ignore these guys, let them come and go to Safeway, let them get complacent, don't engage in a fight, you're not going to satisfy the desire to be martyrs, you're not going to create the kind of imagery that I think some of them wanted to see, and eventually they're going to let their guard down, and then you can arrest them, and that's exactly what played out, but man, it was frustrating. I think one of the most difficult parts of it was how it was for our employees and how it was for Burns Paiute tribal members to day after day see their work be undermined, to see pictures of their offices with other people in them, to worry about their mission and how it was being undermined and to feel powerless about it, not to mention the fact that many of them had people in vehicles across the street from their personal houses staring them down and stalking them through the grocery store. We had to move people off-site for more than a month at a time. They had to take their children out of school in order to keep their families safe. And that was devastating. And having gone to the refuge after the occupation ended, I didn't want to go during because then you draw attention, and that's not what we wanted to do. But I went immediately after, and they're shell-shocked. And I think this is many people who have just been so dedicated to this work are not going to stay, and that's because it's an experience that they can't get out of their head. Every one of their papers were gone through All their files were in a shambles. The safes were broken into. The site was very impacted, which was a big risk for tribal artifacts and a burial ground that was there. So there's no winners in that situation, but you know, other than the what I think was a clear provocation of law enforcement by Lavoy Finicum, who was shot when he reached in his pocket to pull a gun on the law enforcement folks on their way to rally more support. I think the FBI handled it incredibly well. And I think that if there is any kind of a silver lining, those of you that hadn't heard of malware before now have heard of it. And I hope you go and enjoy
great birds.
But I mean, how does it, the precedent is concerning. The fact that during your tenure, there were two examples where armed white militias were, some would say, successful against the federal government. What precedent is that set, and how does that feel from where you sit?
Well, when the perpetrators of the crime at Malheur were acquitted, I think we were all stunned. I was sitting in a, I guess this is one of those low points, I was sitting in what was a lovely public meeting in Birmingham, Alabama, in the 16th Street Baptist Church, where three little girls were murdered during the civil rights struggle, right by the park where kids were harassed by police, to hear about whether we should do a national monument to civil rights in Birmingham. It was a lovely gathering as I listened to people come up one after another to talk about the importance of Birmingham in our nation's history. And my an aide slips me a note and says, I need you right now to call chief of staff. Bundy's acquitted, shots fired at Standing Rock. I'm like, really? Okay. It's like about this size of an audience in the 16th Street Baptist Church. I'm with the mayor and the head of the park service and Congresswoman Terry Sewell. And so I slipped away and took the call. And shots fired at Standing Rock turned out to not be a serious incident, but we all felt sick. How can this happen? And one of the conversations I had with Senator Merkley from Oregon afterwards is, what's the matter with our laws? And the answer is, in this case, in other cases where we have tried and convicted people, for example, of looting graves around Bears Ears, which is something you may want to talk about later, they've been misdemeanors. Criminal trespass is a misdemeanor. And to prove a conspiracy, which was the case that the Justice Department chose to bring, had too high of a bar to prove. And this is also an issue in the first trial around Bunkerville. So we have a problem with the laws the way they're written, and that is what lawmakers must do, is to tackle this and say, all right, we've now had multiple examples of this. How do we fix these laws? And it may not happen in this administration, but I think it will happen over the long term.
Let's talk about Bears Ears. Let's talk about national monuments. During his time in office, President Obama put millions of acres in the West, the Hawaiian Islands, the ocean, under protection. And now that protection is under threat, very real threat. I guess it seems sometimes in watching some of the things that President Trump does that they are, that this move in particular is as much symbolic as anything else. How do you read this? What's the message that's being sent here?
Well, I think the thing that's obvious to those of us that work for President Obama is that about the only strategy that the Trump administration has is to undo what the Obama administration did. I mean, it's across every agency, it's stunning. So if it's not in writing, I think it certainly has happened. But in this case, there's politics involved. There's two monuments, Grand Staircase Escalante in Utah, which President Clinton proclaimed in 1996, and Bears Ears National Monument, also in Utah, that President Obama proclaimed near the end of 2016. And Utah politicians, I have learned, actually from speaking with them directly, including the conversation I had with Governor Herbert about, you're sheriffs are trying to take over our national parks by force is that taking on the federal government and pushing back is good politics in Utah. It's the way you get elected forever. So I think that that plays into it. Orrin Hatch, Senator Hatch, is the chairman of the very powerful finance committee, which President Trump is going to need for tax reform. Rob Bishop is chairman of the House Natural Resources Committee, and this is something I actually have worked with him on protecting bear's ears with Congressman Bishop since 2013 when I first went into office. That's another whole part of the story that is not something he likes to talk about. Jason Chaffetz was the head of the House Oversight Committee, which would have been responsible for, or is responsible, under Chaffetz's leadership, would have been responsible for looking at Trump in the Russia investigation. And so there were reasons why the Trump administration wanted to do a favor to Utah. And I think taking on public lands in Utah and these monuments in particular is good politics for Utah. They've actually done nothing yet. Secretary Zinke was supposed to come out with a report on bear's ears some time ago. He said that he thought they should consider shrinking the monument substantially, like from 1.35 million acres to 160,000. You can't protect a resource like Native American artifacts by drawing little bubbles around them. It doesn't work that way. But what they actually came out with in the report to President Trump just said, we're going to give you some recommendations soon. And they're secret right now. And that's where they are right now. So it could be that they take no action and they say, we don't like these and here's what we recommend Congress do. And we believe that we should advocate as the administration with Congress to get this done and to make these changes. Or they could attempt to make the changes themselves. I believe that action would be illegal. Because it was clarified, the Antiquities Act written in 1906 and first used by President Teddy Roosevelt and used, by the way, by 8 Republicans and 8 Democrats since that time, including on the Marine monuments significantly by George W. Bush with the protection of Papahanaumokuakea in Hawaii, the northwestern Hawaiian island archipelago, which he took out to 50 miles and President Obama took out to 200 miles, and the Pacific Remote Islands National Monument, again, going from 50 to 200 miles around many of the islands and atolls that are in US ownership because of World War II. So, I mean, Republicans and Democrats have used this equally and clarified in laws in 1970 and 1976, only Congress can make modifications. So the modifications that have been made historically were made before that clarification was put in place. So there's no question there'll be a legal challenge if they make a move. So they may not make a move, but I mean, I think honestly politics is driving this.
Yeah, so it is House of Cards basically is what you're telling me.
Well, I've never had time to watch any of it, but you know, it's, TV is not really my thing, but I'll take your word for it actually. Fashion is my thing.
That's right.
Yeah,
obviously.
Except this is wicking and quick dry.
That's right. She's better prepared than I am.
Hers is silk, and I got these little vents, so if I get hot. That won't work on radio.
No,
sorry.
We'll post lots of selfies.
You can edit it out.
That's right. Well, I mean, I think looking at Bear's Ears and what's happened, it's been interesting to see companies taking a public stance. Patagonia came out with a whole ad about that was not about their clothing. It was about an environmental stance on national monuments and protection of wild places. And I wonder, from a business standpoint, is that risky?
I think Patagonia, it has taken stances on things, genetically modified organisms and so on. That's been part of their brand ethos. But I think for a brand like REI, for example, it is a little bit different. And I do think that when you are working in areas that really align with your customers' interests, that it's less risky. I mean, the reality is when you take a stand on a political issue, if somebody agrees with you, they'll continue to shop with you, and if they disagree with you, they may get mad and never shop again, right? If you're a consumer-facing organization, maybe a little less risky for a Boeing or an oil company.
Right.
But for a consumer-facing organization, it is difficult. But I think that the reality is, and many people have heard me say this, and I certainly understood it in Washington, D.C., if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. If you're not at the table, you're on the menu. And so I think there is an awakening with companies in the outdoor industry, for example, and this started many years ago, that, hey, we have to tell our story. We can't let others always just carry the water for us. Our business, the mountaineer's business, depends on public lands being accessible and available for people to enjoy in the form of outdoor recreation. But oh, by the way, who doesn't like outdoor recreation? Everybody in this room does, I'm sure. Taking a stand is important, and we can't take it for granted. And there are very powerful interests, largely in the extractive industries, oil and gas and mining being the two big players that I was having to deal with all the time, that are incredibly wealthy, incredibly savvy at donating to politicians, and at using trade associations to carry the water for them while they're making nice with us, you know, in our field offices. And they're very savvy about that. And that is not true for companies, any companies, like the hospitality industry or the RV industry or hunting and fishing, that rely on these special places and have not been politically active and don't believe that that's their part. It is their role, and I think that many companies are waking up to that right now.
Yeah. So you've worked for the fossil fuel industry, and you have also been very vocal about the threats of climate change. I've always found it interesting. The Department of Interior issues leases for coal and oil extraction on our public lands.
Right.
And so it was interesting during the Obama administration, they were, you know, you were talking the talk about climate change and climate agreements, and then also allowing for this, the extraction of these fossil fuels that were a key contributor to the problem.
Right.
I wonder, what is the best path forward for how we look at fossil fuel extraction on our public lands?
You know, it's a really complicated question. And the reality is we're all dependent on fossil fuels. Anybody not burn a single fossil fuel today? Okay. And we're pretty fortunate up here. We have hydroelectric power, you know, so if you stayed home, you might not have burned any directly. But for the most part, we're all dependent on them. And it takes time to wean ourselves from that, and it takes viable alternatives, and there are a number of ways to get at that. And the federal government plays a really, really important role. So if you think about mileage standards in cars, CAFE standards, they're called, set by the EPA, have been critically important to increasing fuel efficiency. One thing that I learned from these very effective lobbyists in the oil and gas industry is that the subsidies that were in place to support oil and gas when I was in the industry myself and then as a banker dealing with natural resources have been around for over 30 years. We are still incenting oil companies with things like accelerated, it's called intangible drilling costs, but it's accelerating depreciation on the drilling of wells, and yet that's exactly the things, the same incentives that the oil industry is fighting that are being recommended for solar and wind energy.
Yeah.
Okay, so this needs to be a really big bright spotlight shined on the very real incentives and the lack of return to the American taxpayer from oil and gas and mineral extraction that is happening today. And you know, I think that we need to get noisier about that than we have been. I brought it up with Rex Tillerson, your familiar name. He was running ExxonMobil at the time. And he said, we get no incentives. And I said, that's nonsense. Here's a list of 30 of them. And that included incentives to do deep water extraction of oil and gas in the Gulf of Mexico, which brought you the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. And you know, there's fault on the Department of Interior. We dealt with that during the Obama administration in terms of how we were structured. It prompted a reorganization. But we're incenting companies to take those kinds of risks, yet we're not willing to provide long-term incentives to companies to do wind and solar energy, both distributed and utility scale. And that's just crazy. That is the effectiveness of lobbying that I saw that was probably the most discouraging part of my time in Washington, D.C. But the good news is it can be fixed. The good news is we're making great progress around the world. U.S. may not be leading. We're certainly following Europe when it comes to wind energy technology, but that is now getting on a par with fossil fuel energy, and that will really begin to change the calculus. And when you get companies like, is it Volvo that's going to go all gas, I mean, all electric, I think they talked about in starting in the future. One of the Swedish brands. Is it Volvo? Thank you. Sorry? Yeah, okay. Chinese companies owns it. He says when you look at actually the technology investments in China, in India, and other parts of the world, we will be the followers rather than the leaders because of the stand we've taken that really does prop up the fossil fuel industry. But this is not that difficult to fix, and that's the good news. And the world is moving, and we can follow, and that's okay.
We're one of the episodes in season two we're going to be talking to. I interviewed David Rank, who had just resigned as head of the embassy in China, in Beijing, because President Trump pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement. And I'm really curious, one of the things he said to me was that when the U.S. and China are both at the table, then real stuff can start to happen. And the minute one of them walks away, it's like the center of gravity shifts and neither of them is as accountable.
That's
and I
exactly
wonder,
right.
What I'd love to hear your thoughts about Trump's move to pull us out of Paris and just what that might mean for American competitiveness.
I think it's, I know, I'm trying to weigh my words here.
You're done. You can say whatever you want, right?
No,
you're
no, somebody's recording this. You're recording this. I think Trump's decision to pull out of the climate accords was stark raving mad. You know, I was in Australia for something called the World Parks Congress, which is the gathering of all of the national parks around the world, and it was in Sydney. And it happened to be while I was there and meeting with Chinese officials, high-level officials who were very interested in forming a national park service in China, when President Obama and President Xi came to an agreement on climate in advance of the Paris Climate Accords. Paris would never have been successful if that hadn't happened. You take the two biggest polluters in the world, and President Obama also made really material progress with Prime Minister Modi in India, the third biggest polluter. Then the world pays attention. And when you don't do that and you are a big polluter, people say, why do I need to bother? And I'd say the most powerful thing about Paris that I witnessed being there was the courage and the effectiveness of the small Pacific Island nations like Palau and the Marshall Islands and our territories of Guam and the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands and others who came together and said, we are going to do our part and cut our carbon pollution. Please set your sights higher than a 2% C rise in temperature. Please set them at 1.5% because it's survival for us. And they move the meter. Those small countries move the meter, not by saying, you cause this mess, it's your responsibility to clean it up, by saying, we are all responsible. And they were the rising tide that lifted all the boats and I think created the kind of momentum in Paris that President Trump has single-handedly undermined. And that's an embarrassment to our nation, and I hope something that he seriously reconsiders. I do think, you can clap if you like, it's okay. I do think that the people of the United States and leaders at a state level and leaders at a city level and municipalities are going to make the difference that needs to be made on the government side, and I think businesses will join with them to do the right thing in this country, in spite of our president.
very few women rise to the positions of power that you've held both in the corporate world and in the federal government. And I wonder, do you have any advice for young women who look up to you and see you as a role model?
Are there a few?
Just a couple. One of them might be sitting right here.
Oh, the pressure's on. You know, I think one of the most important things is to be yourself, to not be afraid to be measured. One of the things that I've said to young women is don't be afraid to put yourself in a position where your performance is clear to people, because in fact, that is a great equalizer. People look at your performance, and if it's in the business world or some other world, they want their team to perform. That will make a difference. I'd say listen to the advice of the people around you, your mentors. I've had many mentors, probably more men than women, just you know by the nature of the work that I've been in, but. You know, we all have doubts, and I think women in particular, we're really good at self-doubt, and we are really good at guilt, Like, I'm not spending enough time with, Warren has heard this story many times, but I had a mentor, a man who was one of my business customers in the bank, say, I want to take you out to lunch. You just got promoted executive vice president, and that was, you know, an unusual thing. He said, how do you do it? You know, you're a mother and you know, you're doing this job and you're volunteering in the community. And I said, Frank was his name, Frank Stegen. Some of you may have known him, the late Frank Stegen, real estate developer. I said, Frank, I'm not doing any of it well. I'm not a good wife. I'm not a good mother. I'm letting balls drop on the community side. You know, I'm just struggling. I feel like I'm playing volleyball and every shot's a dig where you're diving for the ground just to keep it from crashing. And he said, are you kidding me? He said, that's not true. You know, you're a good banker, you know, all these other things. And I said, well, and he said, what is it that's stressing you out? And I said, well, I think it's partly that, you know, Warren and I had two kids. One of them's right here. He's a little bigger now, Peter. But it was, you know, my day to pick up the kids, and I was a bank executive, and all the strategy at the bank happened after 6 o'clock at night. And it was my day to pick up the kids. You know, they're fining me $5 a minute for every minute I'm late from daycare. Anybody ring a bell? And yet, if I leave, I'm not upholding what, you know, I need to be for other women, which is we can play at this level. And he said, well, you know, did you get a raise? I said, yeah. He said, was it a healthy one? I said, yeah. And he said, well, give it to Warren. And ask him if he can pick up the kids. So I tell you that story because, you know, we feel like we have to do half of everything. And, you know, and that's, you have to kind of think about highest and best use of different functions. Now, to continue that story, Warren came to me about 3 weeks into this new arrangement and said, can you do lunches? I just can't do lunches and get them to school and, you know, get this. So I said, yeah, I'll do lunches. And I also am a regular exerciser, so I'd get up at 4:30, I'd do the lunch. I'd go off to exercise, Warren would get the kids to school and get them picked up, and I could do the strategy of the bank, and at least it was slightly more calming. But I'll also say another... example is the only woman that was on the REI Bank board, REI Bank, Rainier Bank board, get my R's mixed up, Rainier Bank board in those days, and many of you have probably never heard of Rainier Bank, although I know there's some people out there that worked with me at Rainier Bank, yay. Marjorie Evans was a scientist, and she had four kids, and so she calls me up to her office, and I'm in my 30s, and I'm very pregnant, and I'm, you know, a vice president, I think, in national banking in those days, and I thought, I'm in trouble. I've done something wrong. A board member wants to talk to me, so I go up to her office, and she says, and I'm, you know, one guy said to me in the elevator, oh, I see you're buying your clothes at Seattle Tent and Awning.
Oh.
Another guy says to me, gee, I think it's quicker to walk over you than around you. For that guy, I said, okay, elevator people, I want you to look at both of us and tell me which one's bigger. Anyway, I digress. But Marjorie said, when I went to her office thinking I was in trouble, I've got four children. One of them's a PhD in this, and the other's a medical doctor, and the other's this, and the other's that, and I did it, and you can do it too. Simple advice, 1984, you know, made a difference. So I'd say, as I ramble through a long answer to a short question, you know, I think, take the mentoring that's given to you. Also, don't be afraid to be a mentor yourself. I learned as much from the people that think I'm mentoring them as they may be learning from me. And don't be afraid to be measured for your performance. And don't be afraid to speak up. And if you can indulge me one more story.
I think we can. Can we indulge her one more story?
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I know there's another friend out there in the audience that alongside me worked with a guy at Rainier Bank named Gordon Givens. The late Gordon Givens now, may he rest in peace, died a few months ago. But he was a wonderful mentor, a very gruff, scary guy, and had zero experience. He was not a father, no kids. Said, your job is to take on as much of my job as you can so I can go play more golf. Serious, and people that know him will know that's true. But it was okay because he was teaching me so much. But there were a couple of instances where his lack of experience led him to judgments that were completely incorrect. Like the time when I was expressing frustration about a young woman who was a very good loan officer who had a really bright future in the bank who had decided not to come back to work and stay home with her child. And he said, well, Sally, you know, that's the problem with women. They just have babies and leave. Okay, so to set the stage, I have two children under the age of 3 while I'm working for Gordon, and I'm working my ass off. And he says, women have babies and leave. I'm like, so I don't know why it popped into my head, but I said, let's examine that statement for a minute. And in a moment of brilliance, if I can self-tout a little bit, I said, I guarantee you, if you take 10 men and 10 women, age 25, and look forward 10 years to age 35, that you will have lost some women because they will have chosen to stay home with their children, and it is very, very difficult, one of the hardest things I've ever done, to leave my children to go back to work. But I guarantee you'll have fewer of the 10 men that you started with because the bonus was higher, they got the other title, they got a better deal at the other organization. And I said, so why is leaving for that okay and leaving for this not okay?
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Sally Jewell and Ashley Ahern spoke on August 31st at the Mountaineers Program Center. Thanks again to Sonia Harris for our recording. You can hear the full recording on our website, KUOW.org. Tune in again soon.